In 2004, yes, 22 years ago, a movie came out that stopped a good portion of the world for a moment in history. The movie was called, this is not an infomercial, the movie was called The Passion of the Christ. How many of you saw that movie? Okay. I saw it when it came out. At that time, I often waited until movies came out at the dollar theater, or I would view it on a DVD. But I did go and see this particular one. In fact, I kept the ticket stub from Twin Creeks Cinema, March 15th, 2004, at 5:50 p.m. in theater number 10. Kept that in my Bible all these years. Huh? This would have been Bellevue, Nebraska. The movie carried me through several emotions and reactions. One, without a doubt, was empathy. Empathy for Mary, you could not help but empathize for her. As she agonized, and she agonized as her son was whipped with the flagellum again and again and again and again. You suffer with her. You cry for and with her. I'm going to tell you this up front. This message is very hard for me to give. So I appreciate your understanding of that. There were times when you could see in her eyes the love of a mother as he was beaten, spat upon, kicked, abused, and punched. Immediately after the Roman scourging and Christ is dragged away before the final appearance for Pilate, before Pilate, she goes to the place where he was beaten with towels to wipe up the blood of her son. You feel with her as she sees her son fall with the weight of the cross on him on his way to Golgotha. Empathy, no doubt, with me, probably with you. I cried at times in watching the film. I was squirming in my chair that I sat in, thinking internally, please just stop beating him already, will you? And this was a movie. Enough is enough. And I sat there and I squirmed. The thought suddenly occurred to me, this was a 2-hour film. This movie has time constraints. The scenes that I was watching, and I'm watching that, are merely a depiction of reality. It's depicting something that went on in the life of Jesus Christ for 12 plus hours. Obviously, you're not going to be able to capture everything in a 2-hour film. What would it have been like to have been there back in 31 AD to go through the torture that Christ went through, and it was much longer than the film? Would I have been able to bear it? It was a thought that went through my mind over and over. But then the other reaction, the emotion, the stunned silence, while I was observing the film, was that everyone else sat in his or her seat without making a sound. At times you could hear some people whimpering, crying, gasping. But for the most part, we all just sat there silently. Even when the movie was finished, this is the only one I've ever been to that happened, many still sat quietly in their seats. The rest of us exited the theater. I didn't hear anybody talking. It was a memorable scene to me, without a doubt. One that I will never forget was the scourging. You don't see every blow that Christ suffered, but you hear the sounds of his punishment. You see what a human body looks like after the prolonged whipping. It made for, frankly, a very gruesome experience. The scourging was so realistic, so unrelenting, that when it was over, I felt a sense of relief, thanks, hoping that the scourging in 31 AD was or could not have been as bad as what had just happened to Jim Caviezel. But I know it was worse. It was worse. The film was rated R for violence, and it's a very violent film. But probably no more violent than a lot of the movies today that have been conceived in the minds of writers. Back when I first gave this message, that have written movies like Jason or Friday the 13th. That's dating me, but in this instance, we are not dealing with a fictional character. Maybe you could say John Wick, you know? We're dealing with a loved one. We're dealing with the one who has been completely innocent. But what he went through was for you and for me. As we look at the film, I felt something, we felt something, you felt something deep down emotionally, you felt something, there was a reason for that. Mel Gibson explained he wanted people to understand and see exactly what Christ went through to the best that he could do. So the scourging and the crucifixion scenes are very realistic. If you remember at the beginning of the movie, Mel Gibson quoted Isaiah. He was beaten for our iniquities. He was wounded for our transgressions, and by his wounds we are healed. Let's go to Isaiah 52, please. Isaiah 52, and as we prepare for this upcoming season, I want to finish this message today with some in-depth insight into this prophecy. The book of Isaiah contains the second most messianic prophecies of any book of the Old Testament. Besides Psalms, we find many predictions about Christ's first coming, ranging from his virgin birth to his ministry, his suffering, and his death. Isaiah's prophecies are 700 years before their fulfillment. That's a long time. In the latter part of Isaiah, and some believe we are dealing with two different authors, until they uncovered the scroll at the Dead Sea, having a complete copy of the book of Isaiah. But some believe there were two writers of Isaiah, even three writers of Isaiah, partly because of what they found in the latter part of the book of Isaiah. Because there's a section called, in my Bible, the Suffering Servant. They are clearly fulfilled in Jesus Christ, and none portray quite like what Jesus went through, like Isaiah 52 and 53. They show his overall purpose in his coming, and none portray quite like these scriptures from Isaiah 52:13 and Isaiah 53:12. 15 verses can be broken down into five sections of three verses each. We're going to look at the first section today in Isaiah 52. I'd like you to go there with me. Isaiah 52 and verse 13 through 15. It says, "Behold, my servant shall deal prudently. He shall be exalted and extolled and be very high. Just as many were astonished at you, so his visage was so marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men, so shall he sprinkle many nations with his blood. Kings shall shut their mouths at him, for what had not been told them, they shall see. And what they had not heard, they shall consider." I want you, and I've done this over and over the years, the very first word of this section in verse 13, what does it say? Behold. It is a word to us that means to look, to see what has been done. And as we are on this side of it, if you will, it's a prophecy for those on the other side of it, which they did not consider. But now for you and me, for us, it says, look, behold, see. Verse 13 portrays the exaltation of Jesus Christ. There is exaltation at the beginning of this section and also at the end of the total section in chapter 53. The intervening scriptures deal with his deliverance of the world from sin. As I go through this section, I have a tendency, and I suggest to you, to personalize it. My deliverance from sin. The suffering he went through for me. It says, my servant shall deal prudently. The margin says, prosper. Some say, be successful. The New Living Translation said, my servant will prosper and be highly exalted. The Good News Bible, the Lord, my servant, will succeed in his task. He will be highly honored. So regarding his mission on earth, he will be successful. When you look at and listen to the first and last recorded words of Jesus Christ, they were concerning his mission. The words before his crucifixion, the first words out of his mouth were in Luke chapter 2. Remember, he said, why is it that you've been looking for me, seeking me? Don't you know I must be about my Father's business? And then, as he's on the cross, he says, it is finished. Father, into your hands I commend my spirit. It is finished. What? The mission. The mission. In this section of the suffering servant, his mission will be performed. It will be completed in Isaiah 42. In Isaiah 49, he will have great difficulty. Chapter 50, he will encounter suffering, but what is humanly impossible is going to be accomplished. The mission was accomplished. How do we know? The New Revised Standard Version says three things will happen. In Isaiah 52 and verse 13, see, my servant shall prosper. He shall be, number one, exalted, number two, lifted up, and number three, shall be very high. This happened after his death. First, he shall be exalted. Reference to his resurrection. Christ was brought back to life from the dead. But then there's something unique about his resurrection. There have been others that have been resurrected, but they have been resurrected back to mortal life. He then transcended dimensions. He's resurrected to spirit life. He is the firstborn from the dead. Secondly, he shall be lifted up. After his resurrection, you remember, he got his disciples together, and they went to the Mount of Olives, and in Acts chapter 1 says, while he was speaking to them, he started ascending into heaven. And then he disappeared out of their sight. He was lifted up. And third, he shall be very high. He shall be very high. The Hebrew is a bit unorthodox, but it's emphatic. In the Hebrew, it says, he shall be high, very high. The scripture to tie in with this is in Philippians chapter 2, verse 9 to 11. And you can go back and listen to this recording later because I have too much material to go through to slow down too much. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name, the name of Jesus, every knee should bow. So thereby his resurrection, his ascension, his exaltation, Jesus Christ has successfully completed his mission. I've had some things I've done in my life I've completed. But most of them I might have thought I completed, but I really haven't. One of them is this Christian experience, and I say Christian very loosely. But as a disciple of Christ, this calling and this entire life, I'm just now starting to figure a little bit of it out, and I'm going to be 65 here shortly. That's pretty slow, huh? Maybe you're faster than me. I used to think I knew everything back when I was 18 about what I was doing. I used to think 10 years ago I knew what a calling of a minister of God was and a servant of Christ. Oh, was I misinformed about what God says? But by his resurrection, ascension, exaltation, Jesus Christ has successfully completed his mission. It says, behold, let's look and see at what that mission is. Isaiah 52, 14 says, just as many were as astonished as you, so his visage was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. So Isaiah contrasts his exaltation in verse 13 with his humiliation and suffering in verse 14. His exaltation will be the highest and his suffering is going to be the lowest. He says, many were astonished. They were awestruck at what was done. He was marred more than any man. His visage was marred more than any man, any person. He's talking about his disfigurement. The Good News Bible says many were absolutely shocked when they saw him. He was so disfigured that he barely looked human. Another translation, many were amazed when they saw him beaten and bloodied, so disfigured one could scarcely know he was a person. Another version, this appearance was so changed, he did not look like a man. It was so changed you could barely tell that he was actually human. This is describing what Christ endured from the scourging, the beatings, the crucifixion. He was unrecognizable. He was a bloody mess. The pictures we see on TV, folks, in the movies, even this one, are grossly in error with, not so much this one, but many, with the little trickle of blood coming down from the crown of thorns as he's on the cross. The prophecy says he did not look human. There are two memories out of my life that I identify in this regard. The first one is a burn victim. When I was a firefighter while living in the state of Wisconsin, this person tried to commit suicide and doused herself with gasoline and lit herself on fire. Arriving on the scene, seeing this person, it turns you inside out. I became very hardened to a lot of really horrible things, but that's been decades, and I still wake up wide awake and can't go back to sleep because of things that I went through. The average professional firefighter, paramedic, EMT doesn't usually work more than 6 years. I remember seeing this person still alive, knowing the long, laborious skin grafting that she would have to go through. The other one, you may have heard this talked about before, and I have the whole article here if you're interested. If not, I understand. Goes back to the civil rights movement, because so many in this nation have no idea what the civil rights movement was. And the most loud-mouthed ones of them really don't have a clue about slavery, civil rights. They don't know. Racism. There was a young 14-year-old boy from Chicago sent back home to Mississippi in 1955. His name was Emmett Till. He was not educated and wise into what was going on in Mississippi in 1955. His mother told him, Emmett, you mind your manners. You listen to your uncle. But for whatever reason, a dare or whatever it was, when he went to the grocery store, whether he whistled or said, hey, thanks, baby, to the white woman clerk, whether he touched her on the arm, that was a no-no. And might I add, it's probably still a no-no. After midnight, they dragged him out of his uncle's home. They beat him so badly, they gouged out his eyes, they shot him in the head, and threw him in the river. 3 days later, when his body was discovered and transported back up to Chicago, the mother had an open casket funeral. I'm not sure if you've seen the picture of Emmett Till. I will not show it on camera. But he did not look human. That is the case here with Jesus Christ. By the time it's all finished, he does not look human. I'm going to refer to several sources today dealing, because of my background, with the medical aspects of the scourging and the crucifixion. Primarily, the crucifixion. One is from the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, article entitled On the Physical Death of Jesus Christ. Another from a Dr. C. Truman Davis, a physician, testifies about the crucifixion. The final one is a compilation of Dr. David Tarasaka, Medical Aspects of the Crucifixion of Jesus Christ. Crucifixion was by far the worst possible way for a person to die. There are several aspects of the crucifixion that are brought out in these reports that made it very difficult for me to read, but also much more very difficult for Jesus Christ. I said I don't go through this often. In fact, 2012 was the last time I did so. And you will not hear me cover this topic for years in the future because it's not easy for me to give. Because it's gruesome. And the prophecy is, behold, look, stop at Golgotha and look and see Jesus Christ. First, I would like us to consider the emotional stress the night before he's crucified. I've commented on some of this over the years. Can you imagine what it must have been like to know your entire life when you became cognizant of what you, how you think, meaning not 2 or 3 years old, obviously, what it must have been like to know you were going to suffer death by crucifixion? I've had people say, I want to know how I'm going to die. No, you don't. I don't. Maybe you do. I don't for the life of me know why you would. But he did. And as the Passover meal came to its end, he knew his death was near. In fact, he predicted it, and he had prophesied the Son of Man is going to be killed, betrayed by the chief priests, rejected by the priests, and in 3 days he'll be resurrected. Let's go over to John chapter 12 and verse 23. John chapter 12. Verse 23. Because I want to talk about and deal him dealing with his emotional state. Because it's so easy as we're caught up in this crazy world to just kind of like go along, yeah, we'll keep the Passover and we do the things and then we just move on. He said, the hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified. What John is saying is that from this moment on, Jesus Christ understood the time, his time had come. The hour was come for him to make his exodus from the physical life by means of death. We drop down to verse 27. He says, my soul is troubled. The word in the Greek describes an incredible emotional state of agitation. My soul is troubled. The same Greek word is found in the next chapter, the night of the Passover, in verse 21 of chapter 13. As he's going through the Passover, what is on his mind? Verse 21, when Jesus had these things, he was troubled in spirit. He experienced tremendous inward turmoil at his impending death. This had to be a very, very difficult time for him. For after Passover, he knew his death was only hours away. The anxiety, the emotional stress must have been absolutely overwhelming. I've faced some pretty overwhelming emotional situations. It's no secret, I suffer from PTSD. I try to keep that reined in, but it just doesn't go away. And I've counseled many, many people for PTSD in my counseling practice and as a minister. So here we read this. It was absolutely overwhelming. He was human. The physical pain he would experience would be quite real. You see, I've said this before, he had witnessed crucifixions before. On the author, one author, excuse me, by the name of Skip Gray in his book, The Way of the Cross, and I read from that. Around the time when Jesus was a teenager, there was a rebellion near where he lived. The Roman army crushed the rebellion, but they wanted to make sure it didn't happen again, so they crucified an Israelite every 10 meters along the road for a distance of 16 kilometers. The sight of some 1,700 people dead or dying in agony on a cross spaced about every 30 feet for 10 miles must have been an incredible impression on the mind of Jesus Christ. As a youngster, up in Galilee, knowing the agony of crucifixion, listening to the agony of those being crucified, no doubt would have made an indelible imprint on his mind and his heart. And then subsequently reading the scripture, hearing it preached in the synagogues, whether it was in Psalms or even Isaiah 52 or 53, behold, his visage was so marred, so disfigured, he does not look human. And how long does it take for him to figure out, this is talking about me? Can you see emotion? The turmoil he experienced? Mark also gives us a glimpse into his emotional stress that he endured before his arrest. In Mark chapter 14, after giving the sermon to his disciples, he goes out to the Garden of Gethsemane. In verse 32 to 34, he began to be troubled and deeply distressed. The word troubled here in the Greek is different than the one found John in 12 and 13. It's even more emotionally intense. He is deeply distressed. And yet you and I read over this time and time again, year after year. His emotional state is one you and I have never experienced, no matter what we've been through. In verse 34, he says, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even unto death." Stay here and watch, he asks them. This predicament is weighing heavy on his mind. In fact, it's no coincidence. The word Gethsemane literally means oil press. Because there are olive trees in this garden. You go over there into Israel today. I've been there in person. Been blessed to do that. And you go into the garden and there are trees in that garden. Some of those, I was told, that could very well go all the way back to the time of Jesus Christ. When my wife and I were there, our tour guide told us, these trees can last hundreds, yes, thousands of years. And what goes through my mind is, oh, if trees could talk. They would testify to the emotional stress he was under. The olives were picked from those trees and they were squeezed for their oil. It is a very graphic picture of suffering. His emotions are being squeezed and pressed to the limit. And it says in Luke's account, being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and then his sweat became, as it were, great drops of blood falling to the ground. Doctors tell us there is a medical condition of sweating of blood called hematohidrosis. It occurs when a person is under absolutely incredible high levels of psychological stress. We've all experienced some sort of stress in our lives. But as far as I know, and I've been through a lot, some things you'll never know in this life, I know what it's like to suffer emotionally. But as far as I know, none of us have been to this level where Jesus Christ was. I haven't. Under such severe anxiety, a chemical is released that breaks down the capillaries and the sweat glands, and it causes blood to flow out with the perspiration. Great drops of sweat. Hematohidrosis. would have been made Christ's skin very fragile. So when he was flogged and nailed, he would have experienced even more extensive pain. But then, in addition to the emotional, there's trauma. After my bike accident, 2024 June, I was told by the attending physician, I didn't really have any damage. It was just blunt force trauma. Well, that was enough, but there was more. And so, in addition to Christ's emotional, there was trauma, the physical trauma, which is unbelievable. Mel Gibson's movie is the closest thing I've seen that is comparable to the Bible. It's unbelievable. The beating, the flogging, the scourging you endured after Gethsemane, after midnight, all throughout the night. All I can say is unbelievable. By daybreak, he had endured an illegal trial by the lower Sanhedrin. The lesser Sanhedrin had a quorum of about 23 to 24. He'll be wrongly accused of blasphemy and sent off to Pilate. And you drop down to chapter 14, verse 64, and at the end of it, since they could not come up with any charge against him, Mark 14, 64 says, so the officers struck him with the palms of their hands. And the Sanhedrin had their own army. Gibson in his movie said the beating started while he was in Gethsemane till he was brought before the priests. But the worst beating, without a doubt, came from Rome. He's sent to Pilate, but he's not charged with blasphemy before Pilate. You see, the charge of blasphemy, which they are now accusing him of, they could have stoned him right then and there. They did it to Stephen, remember? You see, they wanted to wash their hands of the death of Jesus Christ. So they accused him of treason, proclaiming himself to be king of the Jews. That way the Romans would execute him. Pilate questioned Christ. He couldn't find any basis for the charge. Wanted to release him, but he caved into the threats by the priests. If you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar's. I've had this when I've gone through things that people I thought were my friends said, you got to understand, I can't stand up for this. This is so wrong. But if I do, I'll lose my retirement, my job, and my position. So Caesar's like, he caved into the threats by the priests. They said, if you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar's. And if you look at the history, Pilate at this point in time was already on probation. If he gooped up one more time, they would have brought him back to Rome and he would have been dishonorably discharged at the best, if you will. In Mark chapter 15, I'm going to read this and then I want to comment. Mark chapter 15 and verse 16. And the soldiers led him away into the hall called Praetorium, and they called together the whole band. And they clothed him with purple, and they plaited a crown of thorns, and they shoved it on his head. The Roman soldiers, well, let's keep reading. And he began to salute him, Hail, King of the Jews! And they smote him on the head with a reed and did spit on him, and bowing their knees, worshipped him. And when they had mocked him, they took off the purple and put his own clothes on him and led him out to crucify him. So the soldiers began mocking him. They placed a purple robe on him. They shoved this twisted crown of thorns upon his head. It went into his skull. The thorns would have been between 1 and 2 inches in length. With enough pressure, it would puncture the skull. It could create bleeding on the brain. And if that were not enough, they beat him with a reed. The NIV says a staff. I imagine the staff would have been quite heavy, probably the size of a good baseball bat. And they pummeled him about his head repeatedly. Quite possibly, they could have knocked him unconscious for a few moments. They spat on him. Prophecy says they pulled his beard out with their bare hands. They put a hood over his head and they punched and they punched and they punched and they said, "Tell us who hit you, prophet, who hit you?" The physical and mental abuse, as well as the lack of water and the lack of sleep, made him extremely weak. Pardon me as I read this next section. Because the full crucifixion, before that came the scourging. This is not a spanking as some used to get when they were children, as with a strap or a belt. And I don't condone that type of punishment, by the way. But first of all, the person was stripped naked, tied to a post. The soldiers would flog the back, the buttocks, the legs with a rod, intended to weaken the victim and cause swelling. To a state just short of death, then they would use the cat of nine tails. The scourging, 39 lashes. Depending on the mood of the inflictor, he could go beyond 39. They would use this whip braided, and I was going to bring one that I, but I thought, no. They could use a whip braided leather thongs with iron balls, sharp pieces of sheep bone tied to the end. The whip would strike the flesh. The balls would cause deep bruises, which would break open with further blows. The sharp bones would cut the flesh severely and cut deep into the tissue. The person's back would be shredded. The part of the spine was often exposed by deep, deep cuts. As the flogging continued, the lacerations would tear into the underlying skeletal muscles and produce quivering ribbons of flesh that was bleeding. It would just quiver. It didn't stop. Church historian Eusebius described it as this: the victims were laid bare. The bowels of the victim were open to exposure. It's known that many people died just from the scourging before the crucifixion. But at the very least, the victim would experience so much tremendous pain, they would go into what is called hypovolemic shock, in which the person suffers a low volume of blood. I've worked on accident victims with mass pants to try to take every bit of blood we can to keep it to the vital organs. Causing the heart to race, trying to pump blood that is not there. I once was on an accident scene. I know this is graphic, I'm sorry, but I was on an accident scene. I was one of the first to arrive. A girl that was driving had three young guys back. This is when I realized that marijuana does affect you like alcohol or worse when you're driving, contrary to what they try to tell you, which is a bunch of baloney. But she was driving. The three guys in the back were smoking. And they came. They were doing, I figure, close to 100 miles an hour on this road. And there was a house there. And in Wisconsin, we had a lot of roads coming out. And there was big ditches in front for the rain and have big metal culverts. And we got on scene. And the girl, they had flung, went airborne, and then hit that culvert. And the car stopped. And everything inside kept going. That's what happens when your vehicle hits a tree or something solid. That's why I tell people, when you're driving and you got an option between a tree and a wooden or even metal utility pole, hit that. It may break off. The tree's not breaking off. So they came up and they hit this. And so we get on scene and the woman was there. Such impact, her feet and legs went all the way through the floor past the break, through the floor, I didn't stutter, through the floor. And we're working on her, and there was a paramedic there from Janesville, we were from Milton, and he said, "I need you to start an IV, and I need you to start an IV," and I said, I looked down, and I didn't do anything. And I'll change the language, but he was really mad at me. He said, "Did you hear what I said to do? Start an IV. We got to get some mass pants on this lady." I said, "No. Are you telling me no? We've got to try to help her live." And I said, "Look where her feet used to be." And he looked down. It had completely severed both her feet that had gone through, because her feet were sitting right on the floorboard, and her legs were all the way through. She had bled out. There was nothing we could have done. And he just said, I remember the look on his face. It went from really being mad at me, went like this. He said, oh, you're right. And then the sheriff's deputy came up. I said, we'll need the coroner. She's deceased. And so when Christ was going through this in the hypovolemic shock, it causes the heart to race, trying to pump blood that's not there. It lowers the blood pressure and can cause fainting. The kidneys stop producing urine. It makes the person very, very thirsty. Here's something you may not realize medically. Do you realize when you drink water, it just goes into your stomach and then you urinate it out? You drink it, it goes into your kidneys and through your blood, and it's all filtered. It doesn't just, if you drink too much, you urinate it. Some people don't know that. You know? Makes the person very, very thirsty. The body craves fluid to replace the loss of blood. The weakened condition is most likely what caused him to collapse on his way to Golgotha. He couldn't go any further. Jesus was beaten so badly he could have died even before the cross. Another Roman historian, Tischendorf, claimed to have interviewed a Roman soldier who helped escort Mary, the mother of Jesus, to the site of the cross. And Mary asked, which one is he? Which one is my son? I would say Mary could not recognize her own son. I once anointed a man in El Salvador, San Salvador, the capital, at a hospital. That's where it was, right, Gail? Who had been bludgeoned to death by a gang, church member. And I remember going in with his wife into the hall lined with all these people on gurneys, some of them dead, moaning, because they only had one physician. It was Christmas Eve for them. And one physician for the whole hospital. So people were just there. He couldn't do anything with him yet. And we were going through looking at all these gurneys because I was going to go anoint someone, pray with them, put my hands on them, apply oil if I could, and put my hands on them. But we finally found him because she recognized his hand dripping with blood with a ring on it. But the rest of him was beaten so badly. And so I just took my finger and I touched that finger and prayed for him. I've never seen somebody beaten that badly. And so she said, which one is my son? He was beaten like an animal. He didn't even look human. Therefore, even before the actual crucifixion, his physical condition was very, very serious. Can we picture that? Can we picture, if you could determine his eyes, they were swollen shut? Can we picture skin bloodied from the soldiers ripping out his beard, his flesh torn, his nose smashed, bleeding? Why? Why? Because he did that for you and for me. Could there have been a different way? Yes. But God said, no. I'm going to send him through the worst of what humans can do to one another. And now we come to the crucifixion. The word used to describe the pain of crucifixion is excruciating. It literally means out of the cross. After the beating, the victim carried his own cross from the flogging post to the side of the crucifixion. Since the weight of the entire cross was well over 300 pounds, only the crossbar was carried. And I'm going to say this now. There are a number of fellowships that teach, oh no, it was Staros. It had to be a stake. I have researched and studied this enough. Stop it already. I had a man, a minister he claims to be, give a whole sermon after me and telling me how wrong I was and everything I said was heresy. Shame on you. You'll have to answer to that, not me. But the weight of the entire cross is over 300 pounds. Only the crossbar was carried. It's called the patibulum. That's Latin. It weighs 75 to 125 pounds. It's placed across the neck and balanced on the shoulders. A complete Roman military guard headed by a centurion led the processional to the site of the crucifixion. In Christ's case, he was crucified. I've been there in a specific place called Golgotha, the place of the skull. And it sort of looks like a skull when you look at it certain ways, the rock formation. And many deaths have occurred there. After the victim carried his cross to Golgotha, he was stripped naked. Most images of the crucifixion of Christ on TV and in movies show him clothed in undergarments for modesty, and I thank God for that. Although at that point, it wouldn't have really mattered, I don't think, to tell what he was or it was. But crucifixions were done and the victim was completely naked. This is God, who has come down from his throne among us as humans, peons, because of his love, and he's gone so low as crucifixion for me and for you. To the point he could have very well been the ultimate of humiliation if you said naked alone. Humiliated, he was thrown to the ground on his back so they could nail him to the cross. His wounds tore open, again filled with dirt. With every breath they scraped against the rough wood. As a result, blood loss continued throughout the crucifixion. His arms were outstretched, but not stretched too tight. His wrists were nailed to the patibulum. It's been shown that the ligaments and the bones of the wrists can support the weight of a body hanging from them where the palms cannot. Nails, if driven between the palms, will strip out between the fingers when made to support the weight of the human body. There's a misconception may come about from the understanding of Christ's words to Thomas, "Observe my hands." Anatomists, both modern and ancient, have always considered the wrists as part of the hand. The nails used to fasten the wrists were spikes that were 5 to 7 inches long, tapered to a sharp point. I used to have some cement nails that were black. You may remember them. They're square. They're hardened so you can use them through cement. Perhaps they looked like that, but they were a lot bigger. And so they were driven through the wrists about an inch below the palm. A nail driven into this area of the wrist would lock the hand securely to the crossbeam. The person could not fall. The nails crushed the sensory median nerves. It's one of the larger nerves of the human body. It would have created an incredible, enormous amount of pain, causing bolts of excruciating pain in both arms. I will tell you this from when I had my shoulder injury and my bicep that was completely torn off, that the radiation, even from, and I had this last night trying to sleep, where I fractured my clavicle in two places, it radiates. And so last night it was killing me all through here, and that's not where it hurt. I knew it was up here because I had it before. But so it radiated. Bolts of excruciating pain in both arms. At this point, the victim would be hoisted as the crossbeam was attached to the vertical stake. Nails were driven through his feet, crushing the nerves in his feet, rendering a similar type of pain that was felt in his wrists. The position of the arms on the crossbeam stretched the arms beyond the normal ability for them to stretch, usually about 6 inches beyond, which in most cases, both shoulders would dislocate. I know what it's like to have an almost completely torn rotator cuff and partial dislocation. But both of his shoulders would completely dislocate. Crucifixion was usually death by asphyxiation. The weight of the body pulled down on the outstretched arms and shoulders. The intercostal muscles were stuck in an inhalation state and hindered the ability to exhale, making breathing shallow at best. Muscle cramps made breathing even harder. In this strangely contorted position, the person could breathe in, but he could not relax the muscles of his ribcage sufficiently to breathe out. Thus, to exhale, he had to push himself up using mainly his legs. I have difficulty when I'm on the floor getting up. I have to grab something to get up or ask for help. I can't get up. My legs have become weakened due to multiple surgeries. I'm not whining. I'm just saying I barely understand a little bit, but I understand enough that I have to grab something to get up. Well, he had to push himself up using mainly his legs. Because he was nailed to the cross at his wrists and feet, the twisting motion would push the nails again against his bone and cause even more pain. After managing to exhale, the person would then be able to relax and take another breath in. Again, he would have to push himself up to exhale, scraping his back on the wood, very coarse, twisting the nails into his feet and wrists again. As a result, each effort to breathe became agonizing and tiring and led eventually to asphyxia. The Romans had become such experts at crucifixion, they were able to predict within 4 hours by the angle they used in bending the knees to push up. Often to speed up a person's death, Roman soldiers would just break the victim's legs with a club so he couldn't push up any longer. But Christ did not die from asphyxiation. He was crucified at 9 a.m. He was dead by 3 p.m. 6 hours usually did not kill a man who was crucified. They wanted it to be a lingering form of death. Normally it would take a minimum of a day for an individual to expire. In Smith's Bible Dictionary, in the middle of the article on crucifixion, it says, and I quote, "The feet were but a little raised above the earth. The victim was in full reach of every hand that might choose to strike him." A death by crucifixion seems to include all the pain and death that they can have of the horrible and the ghastly. Dizziness, cramp, thirst, starvation, sleeplessness, traumatic fever, tetanus, publicity of shame, long continuance of torment, horror of anticipation, mortification of unattended wounds, all intensified up to the point to which they can be endured at all, but all stopping just short of the point that they would give the sufferer relief by going unconscious. You add this to the exposure to the elements, the heat, the cold, the flies, the gnats, the birds of prey, and the inability to attend to bodily functions. The unnatural position made every movement painful. The lacerated veins and crushed tendons throbbed with incessant anguish. The wounds inflamed by exposure gradually gangrened. The arteries, especially of the head and stomach, became swollen, oppressed with surcharged blood. While each variety of misery went on gradually increasing, there was adding to them that intolerable pain of burning and raging thirst. Such was the death to which Christ was doomed. And Isaiah says, behold. He says, look. And we get these images that come out that sanitize the whole situation. And I just say, no way. No way. No way could I have been there for over 12 hours with what he had gone through. I would have been rather hardened through so much. There's just no way. John chapter 19, verse 31 to 34, you can read it later. Please do. This is why Christ died, actually. When you look at the parallel account in Matthew 27 and other translations, it's when he cried out, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. You know what that said? My God, why have you forsaken me? And he said, I thirst. And so they put a sponge in his mouth and he refused. And at that point and that time, the soldier pierced him in the side and he died. This part of the account from the sources I gather said the spear of the soldier most likely pierced the right lung into the heart cavity, and that's why blood and water flowed. The human heart was a sac of clear fluid around it called the pericardial sac. I'm very familiar with that. Which, when it was pierced, would have exploded and poured out a clearer substance followed by blood, hence blood and water flowed. But typically, a large buildup of this fluid around the heart is a sign a person died of a heart attack. That the person's heart literally burst, it's a sign that a person's heart burst from beating so fast. One medical doctor said that Jesus did not die of suffocation, but he died of a pierced heart. It was not a broken heart due to sorrow, as some might say. That's so lame. The suffering was tremendous. we finish the section in Isaiah 52 and verse 25. Isaiah 52, verse 15, I'm sorry. Isaiah 52 and verse 15. So shall he sprinkle many nations, the kings shall shut their mouths at him, for that which had not been told shall see, and that which they had not heard shall they consider. This is why the night of the Passover, from time to time, here we come, we sit down, we partake of the Passover service, we go home, we do our own thing. 2,000 years ago, Christ in his agony was just a beginning. He carried all the way through that night into the wee hours of the morning and until the afternoon when he expired. In Isaiah 52, verse 15, many have never read this. It says in the New King James, it says sprinkled. The margin has startled. There's two possible meanings. Sprinkled, he sprinkled you and me. It's a purifying act to cleanse us of what? Sin. The night of the Passover, he took the cup, he gave thanks, and he said, drink you all of it. This is the blood of the new covenant in my name. I want you to drink it for the remission of sins. When we go to Hebrews chapter 9, let's go there. Verse 11. Some of this you may never have read, because I've been to a lot of Passovers before I started conducting them that never covered this. I've not heard very many sermons about this. Sad, huh? Hebrews chapter 9, verse 11. But Christ being come to the high priest of good things to come by a greater, more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this building, neither by the blood of goats and calves, but by his own blood, he entered in once into the holy place, having obtained eternal redemption for us. For if the blood of bulls and of goats and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling the unclean sanctify to the purifying of the flesh, how much more shall the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without spot to God, purge your conscience from dead works to serve the living God. To understand in chapter 10, verse 4, it's not possible for the blood of bulls and goats can take away sin, only the blood of Jesus Christ. All of us have sinned. The wages of sin is death. But it says, now there is no condemnation for those who have been sprinkled by the blood of Christ. None, unless we decide to sin again. I heard a story decades ago out of England. There was an old home of an English family discovered that it was on fire. They thought everybody was out except for the baby. The mother went back in to save her small child, her baby. Wrapped the baby in a blanket, dropped the baby out the window. Someone caught the baby below. The mother tried to escape down the stairs. The fire was so great she couldn't. So she decided the only thing she could do was to climb out that same window. And as she was climbing out, she burned her hand severely. And in the process, she let go of the ledge, and her hands caught on the trellis that were severely, severely burnt and disfigured. And the doctors told her there was very little, if anything, that could be done. From that point in time, she always wore gloves. And the oldest servant in the household had never seen her hands. Then one day the baby who had grown into adulthood came into the room where her mother was, and she had her gloves off. And the mother tried to scurry around to cover up her hands, but she said, well, I guess you've seen my hands. I need to tell you the story. And she told her the story about her hands being burned and disfigured to save this one who was now grown into adulthood. And the daughter grabbed these hands and repeatedly said, these are beautiful hands. These are beautiful hands. Brethren, the eyes of God look down from heaven at the blood of Jesus Christ. And he says, that blood is beautiful. That blood is beautiful. Why? Because in Hebrews 12, 22 to 24, it says, Abel's blood cried out for vengeance. Christ's blood cries out for forgiveness. Forgiveness. That blood is beautiful. to God because it implies forgiveness of sin. And there is therefore now no condemnation because I have been sprinkled. And Isaiah 52 verse 15 says in the margin, startled. The New Living Translation says he will again startle many nations. Kings will stand speechless in his presence, for they will see what they had not previously been told. They will understand what they have not heard about. This refers to the tremendous accomplishments he's achieved during his ministry on this earth, but also the intervening years until his final return. Throughout the millennium and great white throne judgment, they will be startled. This is the most influential life ever on the planet Earth. Kings will stand in silent awe at what was done. What about me? What about you? Acts chapter 2, Pentecost, after all this, Peter preaches a sermon. The sermon is about Jesus Christ. He came to the earth, lived, and died, and he concludes the sermon in verse 36. And I don't know for sure how many people were there, but Peter says, you are responsible. Me and you. I've heard people say, oh, if I was there, I wouldn't have condoned that. Really? Oh, my. I don't know if any of them were cheering when Christ was crucified. Peter said, you are responsible. Something struck them. They realized it was because of them Christ died. It was because of their sins Christ died. How awestruck am I? Because my sin caused his death. I am responsible for his arrest. I am responsible for his trial. And guess what? You and I killed Christ. And I am responsible for him being found guilty. I'm the one responsible for the one being spat on, scourged, nailed to the cross, the crucifixion. I'm responsible for the Roman soldier sticking the spear into his side. Am I astonished? John said, these things Isaiah said when he saw his glory and spoke of him. And now he says to you and to me, behold, look and see our Savior and be amazed what he has done for you and what he's done for me. Let's close in prayer. Father in heaven, we come before you. Thank you for the love you have for us and your Son for us, that before the foundation of the world, this was the plan. And I can't imagine growing up knowing how I was going to die and why. But you turned your back on your Son who represented sin momentarily. So where he was completely rejected by humans and by his Father. And yet we know that wasn't the final outcome, and we know what the final outcome of all this is, but it doesn't make it any less reflective and sobering. As we come up to the Passover, Father, whatever it is that's separating us from you and your Son, please help us to dig deep and beg for your mercy and change that. Now is a time, this is not a threat, it's not a scare. Now is a time in human history for those that God has called, you've called and pricked their hearts to respond. And for those of us in the body of Christ to get our house in order. It's not going to get better, but we know the final outcome. And Jesus Christ, as he went through this, it says he suffered, and by suffering he learned obedience. Why? For the example for you and me. Do we get that? I pray we will, and we do. Please bless the food today, bless the fellowship, and thank you for the Sabbath. Protect us from the evil one, please, and his minions and that spirit, and bring us back safely next Sabbath. Help us to take the time spiritually to realize there's not anything else that's more important, whatever it is we come up with, than our relationship with you and Just thank you now. Ask for your spirit of encouragement and help. And we love you and thank you in Jesus Christ's name. Amen.